expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guest do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
The Paranormal View. The Paranormal View. The Paranormal View.
You are about to enter a world that's not new. A world that will inspire you with pondering to do. A world known only as the Paranormal View.
Time now for the Paranormal View.
The Paranormal View from the Para-X Radio Network. The Paranormal View.
And welcome everybody right here to the Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. Chat room's filling up real nice. And we also want to thank those listening from around the world. Each and every one of them, we love you and glad that you are listening. And we get lots of listeners from around the world. Tonight, we got a great guest on tonight. So if you guys have questions, you can take and private chat them to either Ceiling Cat, Cat Paraview, or myself, and we will get those right over to our guest. If you're listening from somewhere else other than here in the chat room, feel free to come on over. Go to para-x.com, click on the live chat, and you're in the chat room with all these wonderful people. If not, but you have questions of our guest, you can send those to us by sending them to theparanormalview@gmail.com and put in their question, and we will get that right over to our guest. And we also have another way that you can send questions to us, don't we, Kat?
Yeah, we do. You can also follow us, The Paranormal View Radio, at Paraview Radio on Twitter. Also, don't forget to check us out in iTunes. We're in the podcasts. Just put our name into the search area and you'll find us. Please like and subscribe to it.
All right. And tonight we have with us Kat Kloko.
Hello.
Barbara Duncan.
Hello, folks.
And Jeffrey Gould.
Hello, hello.
And like I said, we have such a great guest tonight, and I know it's just going to be full of questions. And he's a guest that we'd like to just ask a question and let him talk for a half hour. So we're going to take and let Jeff go ahead and introduce him.
Well, tonight's guest is the one and only world-renowned ufologist Stanton Friedman. Stanton became interested in UFOs in 1958, and since 1967 he's lectured about them at over 600 colleges, 100 professional groups, and then 50 American states, 10 Canadian provinces, and 18 other countries, in addition to various nuclear consulting efforts. The original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident, Stanton has published more than 90 UFO papers and has appeared on hundreds of radio and television programs and many documentaries. He co-authored Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident, and the controversial book Top Secret Magic of the Majestic 12 Group. In 2002, Stanton was presented with a Lifetime UFO Achievement Award in Leeds, England, by UFO Magazine of the UK. He co-authored The Capture of the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience with Betty Hill's niece, Kathleen Martin. Stanton has spoken at more MUFON symposia than anyone else. He's provided written testimony to congressional hearings, appeared twice at the UN, and has been a pioneer in many aspects of ufology, including but not limited to Roswell, Majestic 12, the Betty Hill, Marjorie Fish star map work, analysis of the Delphos, Kansas physical trace case, crashed saucers, flying saucer technology, and challenges to the cultists at SETI, to which he refers as silly effort to investigate. So welcome, welcome, Stanton Friedman.
Yay. Well, I'm glad to be on. I should mention my latest two books are Flying Saucers and Science, and Science Was Wrong. That's with Kathleen Martin as well, incidentally. And 14 chapters, each inspired by some smart guy saying something stupid. you know, like Man Will Never Fly and Space Travel is Utter Bilge, and you know, there's no shortage of stupidity from smart people, because there seems to be an illness around that people who are smart think that everything that there is to be known has already been discovered and is known. So if you're saying something that they don't know about, it can't be real, because if it were, they would know about it. So
my two favorite examples was the patent office back in the 1940s pretty much said that they might as well close shop, because everything that's been invented has been invented. And the other was back in the 1960s or something, as personal computers, well, more like 70s, the computers were starting. They were saying, well, nobody on a home computer is ever going to need more than 64 meg of memory.
Oh, man.
Boy, and what would you use it for besides keeping recipes in a phone directory?
Yes,
I could think of a few things.
Now, back then, though, it was... they had nothing to actually do with it until they started making a few games to play on it, and that was it.
Yep.
I would assume that when the computers first came out, they didn't even have an internet.
Well, no, they didn't have an internet, and I date back to that era, and my first job in the 50s, we were using very high-speed IBM 701s and 704s to do nuclear calculations, and I'll tell you, you didn't touch the computer. You filled out input data sheets.
Little cards.
Yeah.
And somebody key punched them into cards. Yeah, yep. And a whole deck of, a whole box of cards and a big reel of tape went up to a facility that you didn't get near.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it worked back then. And people were surprised not too many years ago when I got my first personal computer when, gee, Stan, I thought you'd be heavy at this for years. I said, we couldn't touch computers. That was a small group of people. I didn't want anybody use them near them.
No. And so they would have a whole big room full of brains of it. And, you know, you had no clue how a thing worked.
Well, and you weren't allowed. You didn't monkey around with it. It was worth a lot of money. We paid $500 an hour for the use of the computer. That was a lot of money back in the 50s. And so times have changed. And, you know, I had somebody call me, and he wondered, he was impressed with my research. Could I tell him how important the internet was to my research? And I said, well, frankly, it's nice to be able to stay at home instead of going over to the library to find out who won the Nobel Prize in 1958 and other things like that, especially here in Fredericton where it gets awful cold in the wintertime. But I said, most of the stuff that I learned that was exciting, I couldn't have done from the internet. Why not? Well, because it hasn't been scanned. I've been to 20 archives, and... you know, one of the things I found out, for example, is that one of the members of MJ-12, Dr. Donald Menzel, a Harvard University professor of astronomy who was a total debunker about UFOs, how could he be a member of a group that knew all about them? And I had to get permission from three people to go to the Harvard archives and look at his papers, and was shocked to find that he did all kinds of classified work that nobody knew about. A cryptographer and cryptologist, whatever you want to call him. And the guy was shocked that you mean that stuff hasn't been scanned? I said, no, it hasn't, and there's still loads of it that hasn't been. So anybody out there who thinks if you can't find it on your computer it doesn't exist, you're wrong. I'll guarantee you. a little humility is required here. The computer, you know, the internet doesn't have everything on it.
Oh, right.
Now, not yet. It makes me wonder how much of that is ever going to see the
good question.
Age.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it costs money to scan, and mm-hmm. you got to worry about, you know, privacy and secrecy and all that kind of stuff. And, for people who think that governments can't keep secrets, let me tell you, they absolutely can and have. And, you know, I don't care how good you are at the internet, if the classified stuff isn't on it,
you can't find
it. And you know, it does make a difference. Maybe somebody has a friend like Mr. Snowden who will reveal what the NSA has. We know that they have released, in quotes, 156 UFO documents, top secret, Umbra. The only problem is that they release one sentence per page and everything else is whited out. So if anyone knows how to get that out, that would be neat, but I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, I noticed there was an awful lot of blank pages.
Well, yeah, there are. And the CIA, they go the other way. Their stuff's blacked out, redacted, to use the fancy term. There's loads of stuff that's still classified and that we don't have access to. And for good reason. I'm an admirer of national security. It can be a pain in the neck. I had a clearance for 14 years. But there is a need for it.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, so we're not going to get everything that people want, no matter how much you ask. But anybody who thinks it's all there just for the grabs, forget it. It's not.
Well, I don't know how real it is, but I came across a photo that I shared on the PowerView Radio Twitter account of a photo which is very creepy that apparently either a security guard or a custodian took from a facility that looked like either human hybrid aliens in some sort of container facility. And the context was that after it was released, the guy who released the photo, he and his family are missing and presumed dead.
Oh, I hadn't heard that story. Look, security is taken quite seriously. And my first job, I found that out way back in the late 50s, working for General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't exist anymore, of course, like all the other places I work. But you learn very quickly. If you, even though it was a cleared facility with guards at the door, and everybody had to have a clearance to be inside and all the rest of that, still, if you left a classified document out on your desk or in your office, as opposed to in the safe, with a combination lock, you'll understand, the guards would come around and check every place, and you'd get a call at 11 o'clock at night if you left something out. You had to go in and inventory all your documents. And if you did that more than twice, you'd lose your job. You didn't want to do that. Pain in the neck. But it was security was taken very seriously. And, you know, I get involved with the Operation Majestic 12 documents, which I think are the most important, three of them. out of there's 100 fakes and three good ones. And you try to convince people that, no, the guys who were involved in that project would not have told their wives about it. And I've had some people insist, well, of course they'd tell their wives. What do you mean? I said, I've never told my wife anything classified. Besides, I'd probably lose my job, but I can't control what she says or where she says it or who's around when she says it. You just don't do that.
No.
And people look at me like, oh, I see. Well, it's true. You don't tell your best friends what you're doing or, you know, the details or anything like that. But anyway, in case people are wondering, there is a good reason for security about some things. If we've learned technology from crash flying saucers, do you think we should put it out on the table, we meaning, say, the United States, if the Russians and Chinese aren't putting out what they know on the table?
Right. No.
I don't think so.
you would think that if UFOs and aliens are real, that they would be conferring with each one of the other countries just in case there might be an invasion or something, you know, or these people might be bad.
You mean they should care about the planet?
Yeah.
What a strange idea. You know, I tell people that one of the biggest reasons for governments to keep things secret is that as soon as the public starts pushing for, you know, we're all earthlings, because from an alien viewpoint, we are obviously all earthlings, that's going to change things. You know, no government wants its citizens, none that I know of anyway, wants its citizens to owe their allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government. You may have noticed nationalism's the only game in town.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll spend just $1 trillion this year on things military. Only a trillion.
Only a trillion, yeah. And go deep into debt. Yeah. I've already got some questions coming in from the chat room. Dr. Smallwood wants to know your theories on Kecksburg, and he wants to know if you think that the Nazi theory is accurate on that.
Did you say Nazi? I thought I heard you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I did live in Pittsburgh for 3 years way back when, and I know Stan Gordon, who's one of the top researchers around, who spent an awful lot of time on that case. And I'm convinced that it really happened, and there were witnesses to wreckage being recovered, and the government, I hate to say this, guys, but the government lied about what they did and didn't have. I know that comes as a shock. Say that again?
What I'm just saying, the government lied. What the what?
Yeah, they did. And Kecksburg was a good case, and it wasn't a Soviet satellite re-entry. Now, Nazi stuff, there's several books who claim that the UFO stuff is from the Nazis, and one of the strangest theories is that Joe Stalin of the Soviet Union recruited Dr. Death Mengele, who worked for the Nazis, to make up some put some strange looking beings, and that they crashed a saucer in New Mexico to cause a panic like War of the Worlds in 1938, which is one of the sillier suggestions I've ever heard made about this business. Just consider for a moment that the big fuss with War of the Worlds, the radio program, I know not everybody knows what radio is, but what the heck? that happened in New Jersey, which was the most densely populated of all the states. Mm-hmm. And it was played as a news broadcast. So you can't blame some people for being concerned. Why would they think somebody would lie to them on the radio, you know? And you contrast that with the Roswell location. The crash was 75 or so miles northwest of Roswell, where there ain't nobody. Now, why would you try to cause panic when there isn't anybody to panic? You know? And there's no evidence whatsoever that Mengele worked for Stalin. And I've read a lot of attempts. A guy named Farrell even quoted me greatly at great length in one of his books about the Nazi UFOs and stuff. And I keep asking a simple question. If Hitler's guys knew how to build something with the flight characteristics that have been observed all over the world for flying saucers, why didn't they use them in the war? I mean, don't tell me it's because Hitler was a nice guy and he didn't want anybody to be worried about such things. That would be out of character, to say the least. You know, so people don't seem to make a distinction between artist concepts and photographs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I worked on programs where we put together fancy-looking proposals, trying to bid on a contract, a research and development contract and stuff. There's a difference between an artist concept and a real photograph, and also a difference between something that's able to fly around and something that's sitting on the ground. Not everything that sits on the ground that you might think would somebody would like to have fly actually can fly. So in the real world, you know, no, I don't think the Nazis did it. Just like some people say they tested an atomic bomb before we did, and I don't believe that either, because it isn't easy. Throw a number at you. During the war, to separate uranium isotopes, we built a gaseous diffusion plant in Tennessee, and it was a mile long, And all it was doing was pumping uranium hexafluoride gas through tiny holes and nickel substrata in this mile-long facility. We used 5% of the electric power in the United States. 5% during a war to keep that stuff, the gas pumping through there, so pretty soon we'd have enough uranium-235 to build a bomb with. Germany was in no position to do that, you know, to spend that much effort, time, people. They had slave labor. There were certain things they could certainly do that we couldn't do, but there's no substitute for time and money and energy.
Right.
And we were bombing, you know, people forget that there were times when there were 500 bombers dropping bombs in Europe during the war. And sure, they weren't atomic bombs, but still, it was pretty hard to build a new facility and, you know, have enough power to run it all the time and the rest of that.
Yeah.
You know, we're an advanced civilization now. A big bomb back then was released the energy of 10 tons of dynamite, and the first atomic bomb released the energy of 15,000 tons of dynamite. And the first hydrogen bomb, fusion device, 10 million tons of dynamite. And the Russians tested one, 50 million tons of dynamite. So we're not talking about small undertakings or small differences or improvements or whatever. And of course, I have to add, Roswell was the home of the only atomic bombing group in the entire world when that happened in 1947. Pretty special place.
Now, what that we know of, what is the best piece of evidence that we have that UFOs are real?
Well, there's no question that UFOs are real. That's the wrong question. Unidentified flying objects. The government's never said there weren't any UFOs. What they have said is, well, there's no evidence of technology beyond ours. And, you know, you'll hear a bunch, almost all cases can be explained, and that's just because there wasn't enough data. That's the only reason they didn't get explained, which is total malarkey if you look at the big studies that have been done. So it's the big studies together, Blue Book Special Report 14, based on 3,200 cases, 21% could not be identified. If you were looking for a cure for cancer, and you say, gee, I guess there isn't one because only 21% of the drugs I tried worked. Somebody would say, you're crazy. All you need is one. You don't need all UFO sightings to be alien spacecraft. You need one.
That's true.
And every large-scale scientific study has found a substantial number, typically 20%. Some people will try to tell you that's just because there isn't enough data, but on that biggest study ever done, it was a separate category. Not enough data. So, you know, Roswell's a great case. I, of course, like the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill. That's partly because I co-authored a book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which goes into great detail. Kathleen Martin did most of the work. Betty was her aunt, and she has charge of her files and all that sort of thing. But there's such a bewildering array of good cases. I like the RB-47 case. That's a reconnaissance bomber. Six highly trained crew members who were in an airplane flying over the Gulf of Mexico and then over Louisiana and Oklahoma and Texas. This sighting lasted for an hour, and this thing flew circles around them, literally. Showed up on their radar. They called ground people, and they picked up both the airplane and the UFO, and, you know, flying circles around the high-performance aircraft with highly trained crew is not a common occurrence. And Dr. James E. McDonald, a professor of physics at the University of Arizona, interviewed all six of the crew members, and his testimony about that is in the congressional hearings of 1968, which I recommend to anybody who thinks there isn't any good information. 12 scientists, including my, I think I'm the only one who's still alive. That's because I was the youngest one at the time, I guess. That's a good place to look. Lots of good cases. So you want physical trace cases, multiple witness radar visual sightings, crashes. There's an excellent book out, a new edition coming out in July, about Aztec, New Mexico, the Aztec incident, 1948. And Scott and Suzanne Ramsey have interviewed dozens and dozens of witnesses who were involved and stuff. Excellent case. And Scott even went through the trouble, Aztecs in the northwest corner of New Mexico, of hiring somebody to go with him over the maps of the time to see if it really could be brought, you know, because of bridges and tunnels and all that sort of stuff, from where it crashed to Los Alamos. And when I went over everything, son of a gun, you could do it. That's an important consideration. You know, if you got a big object, it won't, a 20-foot object won't fit through a 10-foot tunnel. So there are lots of good cases. And again, the national security aspect is a very important part here. What I would have done had I been in charge was, when the wreckage was recovered from Roswell, you send it out to your best classified labs, and you want to know what it is. You don't send it to some university or some testing lab. It's got to be highly secure. And they'd come back and tell you it's a combination of samarium and cobalt. And somebody'd say, what would you put those things together? Well, we'll get somebody else to look at that. Turns out you get a very magnetic material. And I just laughed my head off when I found out the original work on samarium cobalt was done at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Really?
Right.
Hello, and Ohio.
That's just outside Dayton, Ohio.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big base. The number of people there, you know, varies. But 20 to 30,000 was not unusual.
Yeah, Dayton's only like 25 miles north of me, so.
Yeah, and I'm okay. In Cincinnati, so we know.
Lived right there for 3 years too.
Oh, really? We just had a UFO sighting during the show. I was looking it up, and there was one here in the Oakley Hyde Park neighborhoods, and it's really close to me. And I'm like, how did I miss that? How? Because
well, it's
my husband
easy.
Okay, that's good.
You realize that MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, gets about 700 cases a month.
Oh, man.
A month. So I've had people say to me, how come there haven't been any sightings the last couple of years? Well, you haven't been looking in the right place. You
know? Yeah, it's like my husband and I are big astronomers. We're fans of sky watching. And I'm like, how did I miss? Because we're constantly, when we go outside, we'll just stand outside for, like, not hours at a time, but minutes at a time. But we do this frequently whenever we let our dogs out. And I'm like, how did I miss seeing orange lights floating, hovering just over the skyline? How did I miss this? And this was, what, a month ago? Less than a month ago. And I'm just kicking myself, I guess.
Chinese lanterns.
Yeah, that's my suspicion.
There are such things, and they do have orange lights, but I'm not going to make a judgment, not from here.
We didn't witness it firsthand, we don't know, but I do remember at New Year's, I was at a friend's party, and we did release Chinese lanterns, 5 of them, and then ooh. I looked at MUFON within like that day radius, and there was 3 reports of orange lights in the sky in Cincinnati.
Well,
I'm I wonder who that was.
You know, it's there are a lot of things that can be mistaken for UFOs, and you know, people are poor observers. Look, they report Venus. People are good observers. They're sometimes poor interpreters. Mm-hmm. The debunkers want it both ways. If you can identify it, then you can believe witness testimony, if you can identify it as something conventional.
Right.
If you can't, well, then people are poor witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't have it both ways. The reason we can explain most sightings as relatively conventional phenomena seen under perhaps unusual conditions is because people are good observers as long as you stick to what did they observe, not how they interpreted it. And sometimes the news media will say, ask a witness, well, how big was it? Well, I don't know. There's no way to judge. Well, would you say it was the size of a car? Well, it could have been. How far away was it? Well, there's no way for me to know. A half mile, and pretty soon an article appears in the paper. Witness says Volkswagen-sized object seen half mile away and 200 feet up. Well, the witness didn't say that at all. Somebody's interpreting it for him. So you do have to be careful about the press as well. You know, if you got a sports reporter who's covering baseball, for example, he's seen how many hundreds of baseball games, so he's in a pretty good way to judge things. But one-off UFO sightings, who knows? You got to be very careful, and it's a combination of two things. Remember, it's not just the appearance, mm-hmm. but it's the behavior.
Right.
If we could build things that act like that and look like that, we would, and we wouldn't be building, you know, F-18s and all the other fancy airplanes that are being built. Because in the world in which we live, which will spend $1 trillion this year on things military, that's your concern. You're spending a lot of dough to build better weapons systems. Mm-hmm. You know, like it or not, that's where the action is. And if you could, you would. We built stealth aircraft. We used them in war. There have been plenty of wars around. You may have noticed.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people got killed yesterday in war, but probably more than one.
In Syria and
other places.
I'm just wondering why, if we do have aliens around, they haven't done something about ISIS.
I don't think they care. I think they care about
us.
Number one amongst the reasons I give for aliens to come here is to quarantine us.
Mm.
To make sure we don't take our brand of friendship out there.
Ah.
I think every society, I mean, every country has an air defense command monitoring the skies for intruders, you know. Because you don't want to be surprised. One Pearl Harbor is enough. I hope today's people still know what Pearl Harbor means when I think about it. A day that shall live in infamy, said President Roosevelt.
So yeah.
I don't know what people learn in history today. I shocked somebody by saying, you know, in World War II, 50 million people were killed. 50 million? Stan, you got to be kidding. No, I'm not, unfortunately. 50 million people, 1,700 cities were destroyed. If you were an alien, would you like to have Earthlings out there? I don't think so. We're not nice guys.
Well, that brings up the CERN project, which, you know, now what they want to do is investigate the theory of parallel universes by actual contact, which is to be really interesting to see what comes out of that.
I don't know. It's funny. People want to come up with all kinds of weird explanations. Wormholes, parallel universes, time travel, all this sort of stuff. Because they're not really aware of modern technology. I'm fortunate, even though I worked on more canceled government-sponsored research and development programs than anybody I know, to have exposure to all kinds of far-out stuff that went on. And you know, like it or not, these programs were real, but we know enough to say, for example, that a very likely candidate for deep space travel is nuclear fusion. And why do I say that? Because I worked on a study of it way back in 1962. Fusion is what fuels the universe, if you will, what fires the universe. Nuclear fusion, what goes on, is what goes on in all the stars. That's how they produce their energy. It's not a mass of burning gas. The sun is not just a mass of burning gas. We used to think it was. And you figure out how much energy it's producing, you say it's not going to last more than 30 million years, and it's been out there 4 billion years because it's using an entirely different process, nuclear fusion. And so I don't jump to fourth-dimensional space-time or fifth-dimensional space-time warping or stuff like that. wormholes, all these other things, when we know enough to say that nuclear fusion would do the job, if you want to go, you got to put out the dough. That sounds like a political theme. Research costs money. When I worked near Cincinnati on nuclear airplanes for GE, we spent $100 million in 1958, and that was a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
We employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. So we're not talking about, you know, a half dozen professors and 20 grad students with nothing better to do. We're talking about a major effort. We didn't produce a nuclear-powered airplane. We did a lot of interesting experiments, but it was fun. I don't opt for the strange until we go through the fancy normal, if you will.
Okay.
I like that.
Nuclear-powered spacecraft would be very difficult.
Well, spacecraft are not cheap. They're not easy. The Apollo program costs a lot of money. But I will say this. Many of the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them, will tell you things are impossible, have been steadily wrong down through the ages. There was a professor of astronomy in 1941 showed that it was only science fiction if you were going to talk about sending a man to the moon. And he published a scientific, in quotes, paper showing that the required initial launch weight of a rocket able to get a man to the moon and back would be a million tons. The Apollo weighed 3,000 tons. He was a little bit off because he made all the wrong assumptions. He hadn't read any of the literature by the people who were building rockets. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. That's the byline of the nasty, noisy negative.
Well, I think what we're going to do right now is go ahead and take a break and give everybody a chance to get something to drink, stretch your legs. About 6 minutes, something like that, seven. And
okay,
we'll be right back. And Kat, you get to take us out. And
all right.
See, you will get to bring us back. How does all that sound?
That sounds like a plan. Okay, everyone. You are listening to The Paranormal View with your hosts, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Kat Klokko. Tonight, our guest is Danton Freeman, nuclear physicist, lecturer, author, and ufologist, with more stories to come after the break.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk-time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? Para-X Radio and the all-new Para-X Vision can help. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. Para-X Radio and Para-X Vision, programming for the open mind.
Hello? Marla's sacred cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron!
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more of your time, so I guess I'll be going!
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
You know, there's nothing like a great memory of a great time. And if you grew up during the 1950s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, boy, have we got the memories for you. There was no time more innocent than the 1950s or 60s, nor was there a time more politically explosive. Hi, this is Steve Shockley, a.k.a. The Shock. Join me live every Friday and Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern for a Baby Boomer Rock with a Shock sock hop on Rock with a Shock. Radio.com.
Hi, I am John Zaffis, and you are listening to Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.
Para-X Radio presents Real Persons of Genius.
Real Persons of Genius.
Today, we salute you, Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Armed with nothing more than a laptop and a microphone, you hit the air to scare the bejesus out of your audience.
What the hell was that noise?
Like a dog peeing on a fire hydrant, you always whet our appetite for more.
I just can't get enough.
Whether it's witches, ghosts, fairies, or Bigfoot, we admire your ability to set aside reality and believe anything anyone tells you.
Seek professional help.
So the next time you're kneeling in front of your 8x10 glossy of Dave and Tom lighting a candle, remember, if it wasn't for you, I might be able to sleep without the lights on.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X Soho.
Para-X Radio Network, powered by CBS.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal View here on Para-X Radio. We want to thank everybody here tonight who's coming in from all over the world. And tonight we have listeners in the United States, Canada, Belgium, Germany, the United Kingdom, Costa Rica, and Unknown is back.
Oh, yes, Unknown is back. Bigfoot orbiting the moon.
Yes. Obviously. Yeah. They're because they're all here to listen to our wonderful guest tonight, Stanton Freeman. Stanton, I don't know if you're aware of the study where scientists claimed that they could telepathically send a message. I believe it was from India to Paris without a wireless link. And this brings me to a study or a case that was done, I believe, in Toronto, where several people got the urge in the middle of the night to go outside. And when they did, they saw a UFO.
Well, that's not uncommon. Telepathies, for whatever you want to call it, seems to be a part of many cases. And wouldn't it be astonishing if an advanced civilization didn't know more about the strange, the weird, the wonderful, the paranormal, if you'll pardon my using the term, than we do? You know, reincarnation is one of my favorites, and telepathy and able mind over matter to move objects with your mind and stuff like that would amaze me. We don't like to admit that there's stuff we don't know, and every generation has said, well, that's it, folks. We've learned all there is to know, and, you know, somebody mentioned earlier, you know, closed the patent office or made all the discoveries you're going to make. And if you look around at the world in which we live and go back, say, even a mere 100 years, when you realize we didn't discover there were things called neutrons until 1932. We didn't discover that fusion that I mentioned before was powering all the stars until 1938 or so. We're newcomers on the cosmic scene, if you will. So I expect, and there's a chapter in the book, Science Was Wrong, about all the evidence there is for, quote, the paranormal, unquote, and that gets ignored by the debunkers. There are four basic rules for debunking. And you can use these, it doesn't matter what the topic is. Don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble, and nobody will know the difference anyway. I mean, if the SETI people keep saying there isn't any evidence for UFOs, I guess they expect some people will believe them. Of course, they never talk about that evidence. That's one of the basic rules. But in the real world, you need to investigate, not proclaim. And it's one of my constant objections. It's why I've won a number of debates about UFOs. Because the naysayers, nasty, noisy naysayers, when I'm being polite, don't do their homework. They don't have any need to. They know the answer. Don't bother me with the facts. So, you know, it's a constant problem. And anybody who's gets involved in the controversy has to be aware that that's how the game is played by the noisy negativists. I had a guy talking about Roswell, Joe Nickel, Dr. Joseph Nickel. His 3 degrees are in English, not science, but anyway. He said Roswell, we were doing a radio, an interview. We were in different places. An unknown public information officer put out an unauthorized press release, and that's what happened at Roswell. Nothing happened, just a guy making up a story to get attention. I asked him, you don't even know the name of the guy? Well, no. I said, well, I've been in his home. We've had meals together. Everybody who's read the books by serious researcher knows that it, you know, that this was a real guy, and he was also a World War II bombardier, Walter Haut by name, incidentally. And such a good bombardier, more than 20 missions over Japan, but also he dropped the instrument package over one of the nuclear weapons tests in 1946. You pick your best guy to do that, because without the instruments, what's the point of setting off a bomb, you know? But how could he say such a thing and 9 years later repeat the same false claim in a cover story in his magazine? Don't bother me with the facts. Nobody cares about facts when we debunkers talk. And, you know, it's a constant problem. There's another area governments can't keep secrets. Mr. Snowden put everything out, didn't he? No, he didn't put everything out. He released a lot of data. But not everything by any stretch of the imagination. And when I get a great astronomer telling us that the proof that the government can't keep secrets is how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia, think about that. Is that a thoughtful comment? That's pretty stupid, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, but that's typical. Seth Shostak, when he and I debated on Coast to Coast Radio, said the proof that the government can't keep secrets is what a bad job FEMA did on Katrina and how poorly the post office is run. Now, what's that got to do with the NSA, CIA, you know, all those alphabet soup agencies, NRO? The Washington Post said the total budget for military intelligence 2 years ago was $52.6 billion. That's a lot of money, even in today's world. Of course the government can keep secrets. And one of the ways you do it is by not telling everybody everything that's going on. I've got people who tell me, well, if you got a top secret clearance, you have access to all top secret information. No, you don't. There's a little thing called need to know. It isn't enough to have a clearance. You have to be cleared for that particular project. And the number cleared on some projects can be less than 12. Secrets wow. can be kept.
But and also to keep those secrets, the event pretty much has to be kept under wraps itself. Like 9/11, obviously, I don't believe was a conspiracy. It's way too open, not a covert operation at all, but certainly UFOs could be kept relatively, if you want an excuse of phrase, in the dark.
Ooh, very good.
Simply because most of the events that we seem to have captured or detected have been in the evening.
Well, it's not only that, but also, who's got the radar systems? I don't know anybody who's got their own private radar monitoring the skies. You know, who's got spy satellites? Nobody I know. No person, individual, group, if you will, outside the government. And people think you can't keep wreckage secret? Of course you can. There are plenty of places. People think Area 51. Well, there are a lot of places that you're not permitted to go into. I think of Dugway Proving Grounds up there in Nevada, where they did a lot of biological warfare stuff. Just try to get near there.
Area 51, yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And there's not only Area 51. There are many underground facilities around the country for very good reason. Spy satellites and nuclear weapons.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got the base that's inside the mountain also.
Yeah, well, there's more than one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so people think it's impossible to keep stuff from the press or the public. It's not impossible at all.
Now, I've got another question from the chat room. It's from Ghost Soldiers Doug. He said that what's the best way to ever see a UFO or flying saucer? He said that he's not sure what he would be looking for.
Well, remember the definition. A UFO is an unidentified flying object. So if you see something that's flying and you can't identify, that meets the definition
of a UFO.
But yeah, I've never seen one. I can't tell you where to go and when to go there. You know, I've never seen a neutron or a gamma ray. I chased them for 14 years. You know, that doesn't mean they're not real.
But the best time to look, though, would be at night, wouldn't it?
Well, not necessarily, but it's there are plenty of sightings during the day, too. And the pictures I use when I give lectures like Flying Saucers Are Real are daytime pictures. Because, you know, darn all lights in the sky, what are you going to do with them? Maybe alien spacecraft, they may be Chinese lanterns, as we said before. Who knows? So I like the daytime situation where you've got something to compare them to. Another myth, incidentally, is that saucers are only seen in the United States. Well, they're seen all over the world. I've spoken in 18 countries, and
oh, yeah.
Great interest everywhere, you know, from...
You had the big sighting over in England where the army people seen the UFOs?
Well, sure. Rendlesham Forest
right.
Was a good case. And there were guys, one guy actually touched one. But sightings are pretty common. If you get people, well, I'll tell you how I know that. At the end of many of my lectures, I ask the audience, I say, I get the first question. How many of you believe that you have seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer? I've defined my terms earlier in the lecture.
Right.
Just raise your hand, and I'll just point and count. I'm not asking for names or anything, and we didn't let the CIA in, he says, hopefully, you know. And the hands go up slowly, and I point and count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. By the time I get to the other side of the room, the far side, it's 10% of the people. Each of them surprised that he's not, or she isn't the only one. But then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down.
Right.
And when people come to my table, they want me to sign a book or something like that, and they want to tell me about their sighting. Did you report it? No. Why not? They'd think I was some kind of a nut. And I checked, I remember in one classroom in particular, the professor had been talking to students before. This was not my evening lecture, but a daytime pitch to attend the lecture, you know. And he found out that 80% of the kids in the class thought that most people didn't believe in UFOs, but that 80% of them did believe in UFOs. So, you know, there's been a climate of disbelief created by the nasty, noisy negativists. And people say, you must get a hard time when you speak. And I don't. I come on very strong. I don't say I think maybe it's possible that there could be alien visitors. I say the evidence is overwhelming. The planet's being visited by aliens, you know, and that there is a cosmic Watergate and so forth. I've only had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk in more than 700 lectures. Must be doing something right, because I am not, I don't equivocate. I tell it like it is. And, you know, nobody's, this is not a challenge, nobody's thrown an egg at me. Anything like that.
You know? Now, we had on our show Paul Hellyer, who was a former Canadian defense minister.
Yes, I know Paul.
And he says that UFOs are real, or yes, the aliens, and that they are here, and that two different types are in contact with the U.S. government. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, I've heard stories like that, but I cannot say that I've seen proof or evidence, or whatever you want to call it, about that. But I don't know how you'd get that evidence. I was there in Toronto. As a matter of fact, I'll be in Toronto on April the 11th, and Paul is one of the other speakers at the conference. I was there when he gave his first talk several years ago in Toronto. And I had to disabuse him about some of the information he presented, because he believed that everything that was said by Colonel Corso, Philip J. Corso, was true. And I had to disabuse him of that and point out some of the false claims that Corso had made. Because I believe you got to have facts in hand before putting mouth in ear. Just to give you a specific example, Corso had claimed he was a member of Eisenhower's National Security Council. That's as high as you can get in an advisory capacity. So I checked with the Eisenhower Library. I've been there, spent time, know the people. It turns out he not only wasn't a member of the council, but he had never attended a meeting of the council. And they put that in writing, and I gave it to the attorney who had taken Corso's sworn statement. And he asked Corso if he'd like to withdraw that. No. He made several other claims that simply weren't true. You can't believe anybody. You have to verify. I gotten involved in the Bob Lazar story, and people are surprised when I say, look, I checked five different people at MIT. He claimed to have a master's degree in physics. That's why I got involved, because people were calling me, well, you're a nuclear physicist. He said that's what he is. And so I checked. Not only did I talk to five different people at MIT, including the legal counsel, who said there is no way to wipe somebody's records clean. They've been doing classified work up there for back in the 40s, as a matter of fact. But I talked to his high school. And he finished in the bottom third of his high school class. There's no way he could get admitted to MIT. You got to be in the top 15 or so percent. They might stretch it to 20, but Lazar was in the bottom third. So, you know, you have to check. And is he a smart guy? Yes, he is a smart guy. That doesn't mean he's telling the truth.
Not true. Did any of the stuff that he ever claimed about the UFOs that he was supposedly had worked on, anything that he said maybe was kind of true or something about him?
Well, not that I could pin down. He said, well, as a specific example, he claimed they used element 115 to an anti-gravity drive, basically a gravity amplifier. And, you know, in a big accelerator, you produce a few atoms of it. But he also said that at one time, Los Alamos had 500 pounds of this stuff. Well, the half-life is less than a minute. There's no way to have 500 pounds of something that has that short a half-life. Unless you can carry around a huge accelerator, which is rather difficult to do, to say the least. That's just a typical example. And he also claimed, somebody asked him at a meeting in Nevada, at the Little Ely Inn. How's that for a dynamic place? Boy. Rachel, Nevada. They asked him if he could name any of his professors. And he thought for a moment and said, well, let's see. Bill Duxler, he'll remember me from Caltech Physics. Well, I looked at my directory, the American Physical Society. I belonged to the Physical Society. First thing I did was look up Lazar, and he doesn't belong to them or the American Nuclear Society. And I found Duxler, no sweat, called him. He never taught at Caltech, only at Pierce Junior College, which is close geographically, but intellectually very far. you know, what can I say? And he was upset that Bob was using his name. And he found out that Bob had taken a course at Pierce Junior College at the very same time when he was supposedly at MIT, 2,500 miles away. That's pretty tough commute. And if you can go to MIT, you don't go to Pierce Junior College.
Right.
They're not in the same league, if I can put it that way. You know. So, bright guy, sure. But I watched his performance at the International UFO Congress in Phoenix last month. I was there. It was the first time he's really had a public performance. He was with George Knapp, who's a fine reporter in Las Vegas. And he's the one who broke the Lazar story initially.
Right.
And I listened to him. Comes across well. But nobody has shown any evidence to correct these little claims that don't seem to be true. That is, that he has 2 degrees. He apparently doesn't have any. And so that he worked out there, sure. And that he brought people out to see something strange in the sky, I don't doubt it. They were working on lots of strange things in the sky out there. I mean, Area 51 was set up for the explicit purpose of developing what turned out to be the U-2 aircraft.
Right.
A spy plane. And they needed a place that people couldn't get access to. Because we were going to break the law by flying over the Soviet Union without permission, you know, violate their airspace and all that sort of thing. And this was done before we had spy satellites. And so you put it in a place where nobody can go, and you're covered. Well, pretty quickly, that evaporated. Some of the best pictures you can get of the area were the Russian spy satellites. I'm sure they get a kick out of that. So I'm not saying everything he's ever said isn't true. Just the important stuff. You know, how they work. And when he described his back engineering work, it sure didn't sound. I checked with several scientists, came up to me and quietly said, boy, he sure didn't sound like a scientist to them. What can I say?
Right.
The burden of proof is on the guy who's making the claim. Nobody's seen any piece of paper in which his job title was revealed. You know, nuclear physicist is a nice job title. You know.
Oh, yeah.
But where is it?
I think what we're going to do, because I got some other questions and stuff still coming in.
Sure.
We're going to go ahead and take our last break, and then we'll come back and we'll finish out, because I know I got three pages of questions, and Cece does and Kat does. And
okay, I'll make my answer short. I get the message.
That wasn't what I meant. I just meant we got lots of stuff. So
we're curious people with lots of questions.
Let's just say for every minute you talk, I have about 20 more questions.
Yeah. Oh, my.
So, in other words, what she means is we'll eventually have you back on again.
All right.
So, we're going to go ahead and take our last break, and we'll be back in about 7 minutes, something like that. Jeff, okay. You want to take us out?
Absolutely. You're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with host Henry Foister, Ceiling Cat Barbara Duncan, Kat Cloco, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with tonight's guest, world-famous ufologist Stanton Friedman. So stay tuned for more Paranormal View awesomeness after the break.
Hi, this is Hollywood Hunt writer Marla Brooks, and you're listening to the Para-X Radio Network.
Ghost Hunters Case Log 451. The time? Thursday, 8 p.m. Okay, we're going to start an EVP session. Is there anyone out there? Can you repeat that? I really need you to try to project louder and slower so we can all hear.
The Black Cat Lounge.
That's right, gang. Listen in. The Black Cat Lounge every Thursday night, 8 o'clock on Para X.
Today's lesson is on Hick Phonics. Aw, noun, a petroleum-based lubricant. Usage.
I sure hope my brother from Georgia puts aw in my pickup truck.
Bammer, noun. The state of West Georgia, capital is Birmingham. Usage.
A tornado just went through Bammer and left $20,000 in improvements.
Barred, verb, past tense of the infinitive to borrow. Usage.
My brother barred my pickup truck.
Bear. Noun. An alcoholic beverage made of barley, hops, and yeast. Usage.
I think I'll have me a bear.
Bobwur. Noun. A sharp twisted cable. Usage.
Boy, stay away from that barbwur fence.
Did. Adjective. Not alive. Usage.
Jim, he did. Deader than a doornail.
Ear. Noun. A colorless, odorless gas, oxygen. Usage.
It can't breathe. Give him some air.
Far. Noun. A conflagration. Usage.
If my brother from Georgia don't change all the oil in my pickup truck, that thing's gonna catch fire.
Farn. Adjective. Not local. Usage.
I couldn't understand a word he said. Must have been from some foreign country.
That. Noun or verb. 1. Battle or combat. 2. To engage in battle or combat. Usage.
You youngins keep fatting, or I'm going to whoop on you.
Government. Noun. A bureaucratic institution. Usage.
Them government boys sure are ignorant.
Hayes. A contraction. Usage.
Is Bubba smart?
Nah,
Hayes ignorant. He ain't thanked but a minute in his life.
Heidi. Noun. Greeting.
Heidi.
How are you? Complete sentence. Remainder of the greeting. Usage.
Heidi, how are ye?
Ignorant. Adjective. Not smart. See Arkansas native. Usage.
Them Bammer boys sure are ignorant.
Georgia. Noun. A state north of Florida. Capital is Lanner. Usage.
My brother from Georgia barred my pickup truck.
Jew here. Noun and verb contraction. Usage.
Did you hear that my brother from Georgia got a job from that Bob War fence company?
Months. Noun. A calendar division. Usage.
My brother from Georgia barred my pickup truck and I ain't heard from him in months.
Ranch. Noun. A tool used for tightening bolts. Usage.
I think I left my ranch back in the back of that pickup truck my brother from Georgia barred a few months ago.
Rats. Noun. Entitled power or privilege. Usage.
We Southerners are willing to fat for our rats.
Retard. Verb. To stop working. Usage.
My grandpa retired at the age of 65.
Seed. verb, past tense of to see. Usage, see view. Tar, noun, a rubber wheel. Usage.
Gee, I hope that brother of mine from Georgia don't get a flat tar in my pickup truck.
Think, verb, ability to cognitively process. Usage.
I think I'll have a bear.
Tire, noun, a tall monument. Usage.
Lord willing and the creek don't rise, I hope to seize that Eiffel Tower in Paris sometime.
View, contraction, verb, and pronoun. Usage.
I ain't never seen New York City. View.
Rat, where are you going?
I'm going back to the paranormal view, back where I belong.
Please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs and all kind of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear,
line.
Oh, you gotta be kidding.
That's the Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Kat Kloko, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
So, you had a lucid dream about living in Atlantis, teaching telepathy, and you're wondering what it means. We can actually help. We are the School of Metaphysics, a 40-year-old international resource for people who have questions. Big, juicy, deep questions about life and death and everything in between. 16 branches in the U.S., self-guided study online, weekend courses, webinars, and books. Send us a telepathic fax or visit our website, www.som.org. This could be the start of something really interesting.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They all talk gobbledygooky, the Para-X family. The shows are paranormal, not stuffy but informal. The topics are abnormal, the Para-X family.
They're strange, deranged, unrestrained.
So grab your favorite brew, it's time to rendezvous, as we give awards to the Para-X family.
And welcome back, everyone, to the Paranormal View here on Para-X Radio with our very special guest, Stanton Freeman. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I am in geek heaven right now listening to this conversation. It is just so much fun and quite intriguing to me. Stanton, I want to ask you a little bit about first contact. And if you believe it's already happened, I certainly do believe it has. And it's almost that cliche, take me to your leader, where they probably have contacted heads of state, and which is why there's such deniability in the existence of UFOs at the moment.
Cece, I think your first part of that question kind of missed.
Yeah.
It did?
Yeah.
It was abducted.
Yeah, it was abducted. Started yes. Again.
What? First contact? About first contact. And
you mean official contact? When
official
you say
official contact. Well, whether or not that's actually happened.
There's a book by Art Campbell who ran across an airman who served as a crew member on President Eisenhower's presidential aircraft, and who said there was an occasion when Ike was supposedly playing golf in Georgia, and he did a lot of that, when actually the plane went to New Mexico, and Ike landed at one end of the runway, and there was a saucer down the other end, and there was a meeting. And Art has done, he's found more than one witness to back that up. So I think it probably has happened. I mean, I don't think they came and said, you know, this is what we want to trade and what will you pay me for this or anything like that. But I think, let's face it, any alien smart enough to get here and tootle around in the atmosphere and so forth would prefer not to have to worry about being shot at. And as a matter of fact, there was an order given to military crewmen in 1952, toward the end of it, shoot them down if they don't land when instructed to do so. And I have talked to, after my lectures, quietly talked to 7 different people who told me about military airmen who took off to chase UFOs and never came back, in airplanes this is. And so I have every reason to think that it's true, especially when you look and see how many fatal military airplane crashes there were between 51 and 56, over 200. And 5 of the pilots had been on duty in Korea where there were MiGs trying to shoot them down, you know, and had made more than 100 missions. That means you're a pretty good pilot. Simple as that. They come back to the United States and they crash. And the New York Times used words like disintegrated and disappeared in several instances. And so a general admitted that we'd scrambled 300 times to chase them and so forth. Just standard routine. What I'm getting at is that it would make sense that there would be some communication, because the cases I heard, it sounds like these are in self-defense, so to speak. And that these weren't nasty UFOs trying to shoot everything out of the sky, but if you shoot at them, they'll shoot back. So that I think that there would need to be such meetings, especially if the alien point of view was that, look, we're not here to destroy you guys, but we sure as heck don't want you taking your brand of friendship out where we are.
Yeah.
Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah,
I mean, we're nasty. And people get upset at me when I say that. I was interviewed by a reporter when I went through the litany of, you know, we killed 50 million of our own kind and destroyed 600 cities, or 16, anyway, a whole bunch of cities. And she said, well, I don't believe that. What don't you believe? I don't think we killed 50 million of our own kind. I said, how many do you think died during World War II? This is a woman with a college degree working for a New York television station. She says, oh, 3 or 4 million, maybe. Only 3 or 4 million.
Oh, grief.
And, you know, there's a long way. If she'd said 40, I wasn't going to argue with her. Some people say 60 million. You know, the Russians lost 20 million, for goodness sake.
At least, yeah.
Yeah, so we don't know, have a precise number. But there's an educated person who thinks that only 3 or 4 million people got killed during the war. So war is hell, as somebody once said, and it wasn't me. What I'm saying is that if their purpose is to make sure that we don't take our brand of friendship out there, you'd think that there would be some contact. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Russians and Chinese, so forth as well,
has had that contact also. Yeah.
What about the Vatican? It's really big turnaround, and now all of a sudden, oh yeah, there must be aliens out there.
Well, you know, several years ago, the Pope said that I see no reason why the good Lord who made us couldn't have made our brethren in outer space. An interesting choice of terminology. And my first thought was, who's he been talking to? And I've been at a conference where, he's dead now, but Father Balducci, who worked at the Vatican, was at UFO conferences, listening, paying attention. So I would expect them to be interested and concerned and, you know, wanting to keep up with what's going on. And There's a book out by a guy from Vanderbilt University named Weintraub about religion and extraterrestrials. And it's a kind of scholarly book. He doesn't say much about UFOs, surprisingly, but he does indicate that all the major religions, and there were a couple I had never heard of, for goodness sakes, have worried about this question of life out there. And, you know, did Jesus die to save them as well as us? You know, that sort of question. And it's ebbed and flowed in attitudes. And there are several religions who take it as a given that there's life out there that could be coming here. But, you know, when people say, what would happen if the truth comes out? One of the things I say, well, church attendance would go up, mental hospital admissions would go up, the stock market would go down, and the younger generation would push for a new view of ourselves instead of as Americans, Greeks, Peruvians, whatever, as earthlings. And no government wants that. So if I met with aliens, and, you know, I have great admiration for the man, not just because I've spent time at the Eisenhower Library, but can you imagine how difficult it must have been when he was asked to get the Germans to join with the French, English, and Americans to stand strong against the Russians after the war? Now, that was his job. Now, we just fought two wars with the Germans. How many troops on, you know, our side got killed? And yet Ike managed to do it.
Right.
And that deserves all our respect, because I don't know of many, certainly General Montgomery from the English couldn't have done it. So if you're going to talk to somebody who knows the hell of war, who knows about keeping secrets, and, you know, in his final address to the country, you talked about the
military-industrial complex.
Yeah, and he warned about that in the larger sense of he wanted to make sure that, well, he set up a group that most people never heard of, Project Solarium, named after the room at the White House where they met initially. Three different groups met, each with a different approach to containment of the Soviet Union. This is in 1953. He came in office in January of 53, and this is that summer. And the very existence of that group wasn't revealed until the 1980s. But they set national policy for more than 20 years. And his concern was that we were moving too much in the direction of, believe it or not, a military approach to containment, as opposed to a more peaceful, if you will, approach. And to me, one of the great miracles of the time since the Second World War is that nobody has exploded any atom bombs on people. People don't realize, maybe, that we have exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons. Only two on people, Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And we were the ones that did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But out of that 2,000, then there were Russian ones and English ones and French ones and Korean ones and North Korean and so forth. But the fact that we haven't, despite all the little wars that have gone on, that no more bombs have been dropped on people, that's quite remarkable. I mean, I'm grateful. I've got a great grandson. I'd like to see him grow up, you know.
Yeah. I've met a Hiroshima survivor. It's not pretty what the bombs did to people.
I would certainly agree with you. I mean, I'm a nuclear guy, but I'm not looking, let's set off a bomb to show them how powerful we are.
Right.
Not at all. But you can understand that alien visitors, I'm presuming every civilization is concerned about having somebody attack them in secret.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Pearl Harbor, if you will, out on Zeta Reticuli or someplace. So I think they'd all be checking out what civilizations are entering this stage of too much technology and not enough sociology, and we're certainly in that stage. I mean, how can we justify spending $1 trillion on things military when loads of kids die every single day on this planet from preventable disease or starvation. How does that look to anybody else? We're idiots. Yeah. A primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. You know, it's the simplest way to describe it from my viewpoint. Yeah. So, it worries the heck out of me, and I think that, thank goodness for people like Eisenhower. And I think it's one of the concerns of the Majestic 12 group, whatever its name is now, once the code word gets used, then you change it, but is to avoid starting a war by doing something stupid.
Right.
And yeah. Mankind has a long history of stupidity.
You know? Yes.
Well, I guess my question then would, what would that alien blockade be then? Are they simply telling us not to? I mean, the furthest we've been in ages is the International Space Station, although I'm not sure the Mars project will ever see fruition. How far are they going to let us go, and what means are they attempting to stop us?
Well, I think we have to separate the UFO problem into two parts. One is, how do you get from one solar system to another? And the other is, once you get there, how do you fly around in the atmosphere with all this hypermaneuverability and all that sort of stuff? Those are two different problems. And even if we figured out how to flit around in the atmosphere, that doesn't get you to another star system. So I think that's what they'd be concerned about. And, you know, I'm sure you've had somebody on the program talk about the interference with nuclear-tipped missiles and stuff like that. They're sending a message pretty clear. Bob Salas has written a book about that, S-A-L-A-S, about what happened out at Malmstrom Air Force Base. You know, when 10 missiles went down one after the other, it's impossible,
right?
But it happened, you know. And I better add, you know, you don't get to be a commander at one of those bases without being psychologically tested. They don't want guys with their fingers on the buttons who can't be trusted to behave in a sensible fashion, you know. Yeah, level-headed, I think, more than most, in other words. The government worries about such things, and rightfully so. There are some oddball people around who might do something stupid. I realize that's very unlikely that Earthlings would behave in a stupid fashion, but it happens all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that when you hear those stories, they're sending a message.
Okay.
I have another question from Dr. Smallwood. He wants to know about Tunguska, Siberia, and
yes.
What is your theory on that?
Well, you know, I realized that there was a book, I can't remember the name of it, where they talk, a guy suggests that it was a nuclear-powered spaceship. And I don't buy it. It just didn't sound right to me. I worked on nuclear-powered ships, spaceships, if you will. Also, a comet, they found evidence, even in places as far away as Antarctica, of particulate matter that may very well have come from there. We do, you know, we used to think that everything was, history was steady, and no great changes, and so forth. Now we realize that there are times when something spectacular happens. You know, a little asteroid here, a big meteor there, et cetera. So I think that was the case of I'll call it a comet, for want of a better phrase. There's lots of them around. And it doesn't have to be that big. But it changed the climate around the world for a year or so, all the junk that went up in the air. And we're very fortunate that where it hit, not a highly inhabited area. People saw it come in. It certainly didn't seem to be a vehicle. And I've never heard of anybody, and remember, this is back in, 1906, something like that. That was the earthquake. But anyway, San Francisco quake.
Yeah,
So I prefer the the comet explanation, asteroid, meteor, call it what you want. I mean, it doesn't matter. I see no reason to think that it was a nuclear-powered spaceship.
Okay. And let's see, I got another one from Tabby in the chat room. And she wants to know, how much of the current flight technology do you feel is attributed to the study of possible ET craft?
I would say practically, I won't say none. Let me give you a specific example. There's a picture in my book, Flying Saucers and Science, of me with my hand on the Apollo command module, Apollo 12 command module. We came back from the moon in this round, blunt body. Now, when I was growing up, everybody knew that a high-performance aircraft had to be pointy nose, sharp wings, highly streamlined. And here we're coming in at 25,000 miles an hour, and it's a round, blunt body. And I found out that they did wind tunnel testing of such bodies in 1947, as a matter of fact. So I think somebody might very well have said, well, if these guys can go that fast without burning up, why don't we check into that? And, oh, look at that. So I don't think much of it is. What people tend to forget, never before in our history, at least within the last few thousand years, have we spent so much money on developing new technology. The Cold War, when I was working on nuclear airplanes, we spent $100 million in 1 year at GE near Cincinnati in 1958. That's a lot of money. And there are loads of programs like that. So I think new flight technologies, because we threw a lot of money at it, $10 billion to develop the stealth aircraft. You know, money was being spent flowing like water because we'll stay one step ahead of the Russians. That was the best justification for getting research and development funds. We'll beat the Ruskies to it, you know. So I don't think much of it. I think some details. For example, I think our best permanent magnets for many years, well, I know this, were made out of a combination of samarium and cobalt. And, you know, why would you put those things together? Well, you'd send it out to find out what it's made of. Then you'd send it out again to different labs, highly classified labs, and say, measure the properties of this stuff. And a guy'd come back and say, look, I don't know where you got this. He wouldn't have a need to know for that. But it's the highest magnetic moment I've ever measured for a material. It'd make a wonderful permanent magnet. And believe it or not, the original magnets for the speakers on some of our fancy ghetto blasters were made out of samarium cobalt magnets. Well, I was reading an article about new and better neodymium boron iron. I'm not making those up. Those three elements are sort of iron, but neodymium and boron? Anyway, the new and best permanent magnets. And at the end of the article, it said the original work on samarium cobalt was done at Wright Air Development Center at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And I just laughed my head off. But I know where that idea came from. You know, so how much more there is like that, I don't know. But I will say this. I was part of the people who helped spend a lot of that money. And it wasn't, nobody gave us a piece of an alien craft to work from. It's an interesting world in which we live, but I don't want to give the aliens credit for everything. We may have learned several things. You know, my mantra is technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. Our first supersonic airplane was based on the X-1 rocket, pointy nose, sharp. You know, it wasn't at all the way our high-performance craft work now. And round, blunt bodies were not part of the picture. So we may have learned and been stimulated by examining and saying, you know, what's going on here? What can we check out? And maybe that's what they're doing out at Area 51. I don't know. They don't let me in.
I have to ask this because I know it came up in a Stephen Hawking interview where he was saying that the biggest danger to mankind right now is a total annihilation, self-annihilation. Do you think that space travel and alien contact is the only way that human civilization is going to survive?
I hope not. I hope we have sense enough to change our ways, to realize that there is a need. We need somebody like Ike who's willing to stand up and say, you know, enough. There's too much at risk here. Too many people with nuclear weapons and so forth. And I think that, you know, civilizations can grow up. I hope. Certainly things have changed a lot. And I'm 80 years old now, and attitudes are quite different now from what they were back then.
True.
So I don't think we're going to do what somebody else tells us, but I think we may get the idea that maybe we should act a little more grown up. But, you know, there is no planetary government. How many people think of themselves as Earthlings? The younger generation's getting that way, thanks to Kepler and the other. Do you realize that if we were having this discussion 80 years ago, people would say, hey, look, Stan, we're the only solar system in all of creation. We've got no evidence that there's any other planets out there. Can't see them. If they were there, we would know about it. And certainly we astronomers would know about it. We keep tabs of what's important in the universe, you know. You get my point. But now a new generation is growing up that accepts the notion that, you know, maybe there's a billion other planets in the galaxy. Frank Drake, not too many years ago, was saying there might be 8,000 places in the galaxy that could send signals. Don't you think it's ludicrous? Here we have the SETI community, and I have to get in my plug for Silly Effort to Investigate, S-E-T-I, you know, where they're saying that nobody's coming here, you got to listen for signals. They have no evidence whatsoever that anybody's sending radio signals our way. We have loads of evidence that saucers are coming our way, but they don't want to look at that evidence. You won't find the books referenced. I read their books. They don't read mine. You know, isn't that a little weird?
And that,
when you think about it?
That's one of the questions I had is, why do you think we have not had any response from aliens with SETI? Now, are we sending out the wrong type of signal? They don't understand.
We're not. Well, we're sending out radio and television signals. We send very few intentional signals in an effort to get somebody else to answer. We're listening. Part of that is the transmitters are all on the surface of the planet, and the planet is rotating, so you can't focus on one area for very long and gets out of the beam. And also, it assumes that they're at the same level of technology that we are. We've only had long-distance radio since 1901. Marconi, give Canada credit. Newfoundland got that first long-distance radio signal. You know, it's a tourist attraction where that signal was received, incidentally, outside St. John's, Newfoundland, which I'm sure is covered with snow now, like we are here in Fredericton. So I don't think it's strange that we haven't received the signal. I don't use a slide rule anymore. I mean, I hate to tell you that, but it's obsolete. Progress comes from doing things differently. That they would be sending radio signals to whom and why if they can come here. There's all kinds of evidence that they're coming here. There has been no evidence put forth so far that anybody has picked up a signal from out there, a radio signal.
I would
what
say
for?
That it would have to be a totally different frequency from what we use.
Sure. Sure. And is our equipment the latest there is in the neighborhood? I find that very hard to believe. you know, look at any other area. Like I say, I don't use the slide rule anymore, but I did when I started working in industry. And for people in the audience, yes, all engineers and scientists used slide rules back when I was young. Little devices, handheld, looked like a fancy ruler to make calculations. No pocket calculators, believe it or not, folks.
Nope. Had to use pencils and paper.
Yeah. Pencils and paper. My goodness, no word processors?
You actually had to figure out a math problem.
Well, yeah, and you also had to handwrite your first draft of the technical reports. So I know, I did. Wait for somebody to type a draft, and then you'd edit it, and then retype it. And I said retype, not, you know, put it in the word processor.
Right, redo it.
Look, my name is on 5 books, and I wouldn't be able to do any of that if I were stuck at the use of a typewriter, because I'm a lousy typist. But with the word processor, it's easy to make corrections and so forth, you know. But times have changed drastically.
Well, now, we've got about 10 minutes before we start wrapping up.
Okay.
What was the main intended function of the MJ-12?
Well, to serve as a central, the Majestic 12 organization was established in 1947, September, by President Truman because of Roswell and all the other sightings that occurred that summer. And you can imagine what they had to do. They had to correlate data obtained from examination of crash saucers, you know, what materials they made out of, what are the properties of those materials, can we duplicate them, stuff like that. You had to put together a picture of the observations. In other words, there are airplanes, military planes, and many of them have gun cameras, and they can put instruments on airplanes to find out how does the color change. You know, what frequency radiation, electromagnetic radiation is emitted by these things. The data has to go through a central clearinghouse where it's, how do I want to say, highly compartmentalized. So their job, the first job was to see if we had anything to worry about that is offensively. Where these guys come along and blasting the heck out of our airplanes and military establishments, ships at sea, and all that sort of thing. Secondly, how do you learn from the information that you've obtained about how these things work? Third, you want to know, how can we find out what our opponents across the ponds know? That was on I talked to somebody who was at a listening post, NSA listening post, and that was one of the things on their list. What are the Russians doing about UFOs and the Chinese? And so you have this central processing group, for want of a different way of putting it, and you have to remember the statement made by General Carol Bolander, an Air Force general. He was responsible for the closure of Project Blue Book after the Condon Report recommended, the University of Colorado study recommended that it be closed. And he said, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP 146, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. Furthermore, he said, two paragraphs later, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures designed for that purpose. Well, the Air Force has been lying about that ever since then. Project Blue Book was closed at the end of 69, and they keep saying, oh, we're not doing anything about UFOs. I talked to General Bolander. I've yet to find somebody else who did. He's dead now, so I don't know how to reach him. Maybe you guys know how to reach guys on the other side. I don't know. But certainly, the government kept looking into the matter in a very classified fashion. And again, you want to find out what your enemies know. You want to find out what we can learn. And you also want to try to figure out what these guys are really up to. For example, are they working with anybody else on the planet? The aliens, as described by people who've been abducted and so forth, generally are small. Are they working with the Chinese? The only time I felt like a tall person was when I was in Hong Kong. At a, I'll call it a flea market, they don't call it that, a bazaar.
A bazaar. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was one of the tall guys, and I'm not tall. But you would have, the first concern has to be, what do these guys intend? Are they going to wipe us out? You know, do we need to worry about that? So you'd want to keep tabs. If I've heard of 7 times when airplanes have been blasted out of the sky, there's got to be a lot of other cases than that. So you have to develop policy to respond to that. Because your pilots aren't going to go up if somebody tells them, well, you go up and chase a UFO, they shoot you down. That's not good policy. You know. So I think Majestic 12 still exists with another name. My book, Top Secret Magic, goes into that. Incidentally, I mentioned my books, but you can go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. Find out about all the books and lots of other goodies and stuff on the website, how to reach me and so forth. And I autograph all my books. Amazon won't do that for you, but my name anyway.
Well, I think we're going to have to get your new books and maybe later on this year sometime get you back on. We'll talk about those also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why not? I'm all for it.
Yeah.
There's VDs too, incidentally. And probably soon I will have copies of the new movie, Travis, the Travis Walton case. It won the EBE Award in Arizona last month. Jennifer Stein did a fine job on that, and I'll be putting that on my website when I get copies.
As long as it's not like the ridiculous Fire in the Sky movie, which just infuriated me as how off topic it went. Did you see that, Fire in the Sky, the film version?
Oh,
of
yes.
And
yes,
it was just,
I did.
Like, I was like, do you people even hear the guy? I mean,
well, in Travis's book by the same title, he points out all the things that were wrong. He had no control at all. I think they were aiming at 14-year-olds who liked watching terror movies, you know, not the public.
But what annoyed me the most, really, was that the screenplay was by one of the then top writers for Star Trek Next Generation. So I figured, oh, he's going to get it right.
They didn't.
No, not at all.
No, they didn't. And actually, the new movie uses some footage that I was involved with way back in 1978. We interviewed Travis out in Arizona. And the 50th anniversary is coming up. 40th anniversary is coming up in 1975. It'll be out. It's called just Travis. But I liked it. We had a chance to see it, the final product in Arizona, and I was pleased. And Travis was, too.
Great. Yeah, I haven't actually had him on my show yet. I'm going to have to see if I can get in contact with him.
Good man. Very good man.
Well, it also is interesting that humans still tend to be abducted. And that there's, I don't think that there's a cease in that, or even.
I don't think there is either. I mean, these may be graduate students doing their thesis research on a primitive society like ours. Who knows? You know, check out the specimens, guys. You got to catch 3 specimens this week.
wonder what they do when they catch one of us dummies.
I always like the Far Side cartoon where you got the 2 gigantic aliens and one of them has a jar with one of the little Far Side fat kids in it, and the one alien says to the other, now remember, you got to poke air holes in the top this time.
Well, yeah, I mean, in Flying Saucers and Science, I list about 20 reasons for coming here. their radio show host with a weekly show, Idiocy in the Boondocks. And, you know, it may sound funny, but it turns out Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. A cubic foot of Earth weighs more than a cubic foot of any of the other planets. If you had a big enough bucket, you could float the planet Saturn because it's so low density. And that means there are more heavy metals here, and heavy metals are rare in the universe. Nice things like osmium and rhenium and so forth. They have very special characteristics. Twice as dense as lead, incidentally. So who knows? Maybe they've been mining goodies here for years. And I've asked this question, never got a good answer. What do you think uranium was used for mainly 100 years ago? Well, we didn't know about nuclear things. Actually, it was used as a yellow coloring agent for dinnerware plates on tables.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say beauty product, but...
With radium, they were hired girls to paint the numbers on glow-in-the-dark watches.
Yes.
And they would like lick the bits to keep the points of the ink of the brushes, and they came down with like radiation poisoning and all that stuff. And they were like, radio's fine, nothing's wrong with it.
Well, yeah, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. That works in several directions.
Well, it's also been meant to theorize that one of the reasons aliens comes is the fact that our planet is so teeming with life, what with all the foliage as well, because if you realize one of the first Planet of the original Planet of the Apes film with Charlton Heston, they're running around the desert, and the first thing they say, we found life, and it's just this little sprig, it's just a little plant, and you realize compared to here, aliens might not have as much life on their worlds as we have here.
You're right. There may be all kinds of variations on the theme of life. What kind of life? Also, we have a lot of variation on mountains and oceans and water. It's not all flat. You know, I've lived in several different states, and boy, there's a big difference between New Jersey and California, for example. You may have noticed that.
Well, I'm from New Jersey, and now I live in California, so yeah, I do.
Hey, I moved here from California. People say, what are you, crazy, Stan? never regretted the move. Frederick, New Brunswick.
Are you in New Jersey now? Oh, you're in New Brunswick.
Yeah.
Canada, yes.
Oh, New Brunswick, Canada. It's not the same as New Brunswick, New Jersey, where
I grew up in New Brunswick. I spent 2 years in New Brunswick, New Jersey as well, incidentally, at Rutgers University.
At Rutgers University, in their Theater in the Round, I did 2 productions. I performed on a little round stage.
See, the planet is small.
It is.
Yes.
Getting smaller all the time and more crowded, unfortunately, but... And this year, it's snow-covered. I've got over 4 feet of snow on my lawn. Well, I use the term lawn very lightly.
And welcome to spring.
You don't have to worry about many people come knocking on your door either, do you?
Not many. No. It is spring, it says here, but you'd never know it looking out my windows.
At least it keeps the men in black in their offices.
We want to thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight. Like I say, I want you to stay on until after we're off and talk with you before we let you go. Why don't you give out your site again and how people can get your books and all that good stuff?
Okay, the site is www.stantonfriedman.com. And whenever I send out books, they're autographed personally to the person, people who buy them and stuff, and there are DVDs, and my phone number's at the website and so forth. I don't give it out over the air just because then I get interrupted when I'm doing programs like this. You know? There's half a dozen books on there, and Blue Book Special Report 14 is there. I don't know where else you can buy that. The biggest study ever done for the Air Force. Government can't copyright its stuff, so I can publish that okay. And I'm also here if anybody knows anything about Roswell or MJ-12 or some other things like that. I'd be delighted to hear from them. My email address is on the website. And, you know, New Brunswick, Canada is not off the planet. It's only 73 miles from beautiful downtown Houlton, Maine.
Wow. Just north.
I have a post office box there.
Wow. All right. Well, Jeff?
Yes. Well, you can go to my website at jeffgould.net, G-E-O-F-F-G-O-U-L-D.net. And if you add /2011pnv.htm, that's my paranormal hub, Paranormal View hub page, where you can access previous shows, reports, guest websites, and book links, etc. In fact, tonight's report will have the links to all his books through Amazon, but also to his website, so you can go get a signed version of his book, as well as previous show archive podcasts and such. The official show site is theparanormalview.com. On Twitter, please feel free to follow me at Real Badger, R-E-A-L-B-A-D-G-E-R. At Facebook, just do a search for The Paranormal View, community.magazine. There we are. Please like us and make sure your settings to get our show updates and weirdest articles throughout the week.
Kat?
Okay, everyone. Spring. You can follow The Paranormal View on Twitter at Paraview Radio. You can also follow me on Twitter at Kat Cloco or my graphic novel series at Jinxed Comic. And you can check out what I've been up to at my website, katcloco.com, KatKlocko.com.
All right. And we'll see you guys next week. Next week we have Angie Clark Small on. She's a psychic medium. We will be talking with her. She's got some exciting stuff to talk about. So with that, this is Henry Foister,
Barbara Duncan,
and Kat Cloco.
We'll see you next week at the same time. Good night, everybody.
Come back and visit us again if you dare. Listening to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.